WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Stephen Wolfram, creator of Mathematica and author of A New Kind of Science.
I got interested in the question of how structures emerge in our universe from galaxies on down. Looking at that, I realized that it was actually an instance of a much more general question, which is sort of how does anything complicated get produced in nature, whether it's snowflakes, turbulent fluid flows, forms of plants and animals, lots of others.
Stephen Wolfram speaking on the discoveries behind cellular automata and the concepts derived from that on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A U.S. selected governing council for Iraq met today for the first time, giving Iraqis a greater role in running their country. And U.S. forces have launched another major offensive against Iraqi insurgents. From Baghdad, Kate Seeley reports.
U.S. military officials say they have received intelligence reports indicating that pro-Saddam loyalists and Islamic fundamentalists are planning more attacks against American soldiers. The strikes are expected to coincide with upcoming holidays marking historical events of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. The Army's 4th Infantry Division launched Operation Ivy Serpent Saturday night in an effort to blunt the expected attacks. It conducted a series of raids on suspected pro-Saddam holdouts. Patrols also set up checkpoints and swept through illegal weapons markets in towns north of Baghdad. Previous anti-insurgency operations have yielded mixed results. Men were detained and weapons caches discovered, but the attacks against Americans have continued. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Baghdad.
Some top administration officials have been trying to defuse the lingering controversy over a statement by President Bush in his State of the Union address that was based on unreliable intelligence. NPR's Ari Shapiro has more.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice continue to answer questions about the line describing Iraqi efforts to procure uranium for nuclear weapons. On ABC's This Week, Secretary Rumsfeld steadfastly deferred to the director of the CIA, who took responsibility for the line last week.
George Tenet's statement says it all.
And on Fox News Sunday, Rice, too, placed the blame on U.S. intelligence agencies.
We have to depend on the intelligence agencies to say, no, we're not confident enough in that for the President of the United States to say it.
President Bush is now back in the U.S. Despite having said that the issue is over, he will likely continue to face questions about it this week. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
The senior Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee says a congressional probe has concluded that al-Qaeda has trained between 70 and 120,000 terrorists, and some are likely still in the United States. The report, ordered in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, is still being reviewed by the FBI and CIA. Florida Senator Bob Graham, who is also a Democratic presidential candidate, has criticized the Bush administration for delaying release of the full report. Graham says the administration lost focus when it began centering on a military offensive against Iraq, given the estimated number of al-Qaeda trainees, the intelligence showed. Explosions from a volcano on the Caribbean island of Montserrat have covered the island with ash and mud, but so far no injuries have been reported. Montserrat's population has declined by more than 50% in recent years as people move to neighboring islands and the mainland to escape the vulnerability to volcanoes. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. An 86-year-old man found dead in his burning home late last week was murdered, according to investigators. Leonard Silvera's body was found on the second floor of a two-family home that burst into flames around 5:30 on Friday morning. Bay State Senator John Kerry says the Bush administration should bring other countries into the post-war occupation of Iraq to take the focus off of American troops. Kerry spoke on CNN's Late Edition today, criticizing President Bush for not having a plan to internationalize the occupation. The committee organizing the 2004 Democratic National Convention in Boston has missed four of five deadlines in its contract with the DNC. This according to a report today in the Boston Herald. One of the biggest missed deadlines is the failure to sign a no-strike agreement with unions. And Boston's first Italian mayor has finally made it into the city's bastion of Irish politics. Mayor Tom Menino now has a room to call his own at Doyle's Cafe, where mayors from John Fitzgerald to James Michael Curley to Kevin White have tables and booths named in their honor. Menino calls it the pinnacle of his career to have broken into the center of Irish politics. It's 9:05. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MathLab and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By Halt International Business School, offering an 11-month MBA designed to accelerate a global career. Hosting an open house on July 15th at 6 p.m., 617-619-1154. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org. In the forecast, mostly clear tonight, patchy fog developing overnight with lows in the 60s, mostly sunny tomorrow with a high near 80. Right now, 79 in Boston.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, Stephen Wolfram, one of this generation's best-known and most creative scientists, discusses some of the key ideas and discoveries outlined in his major work, A New Kind of Science. Sponsored by the Boston University College of Engineering and the College of Arts and Sciences Graduate Program in Mathematical Finance, Wolfram lays out the implications of his concepts and places them in a personal and historical context. Stephen Wolfram was graduated from Eton, Oxford, and Caltech, where he received a doctorate in theoretical physics at the age of 20. 2 years later, he received a MacArthur Award. In the mid-80s, he founded his own company and created Mathematica, now the world's leading software system for technical computing and symbolic programming. Wolfram then began working on the concepts he describes in his book, A New Kind of Science. Stephen Wolfram.
What I want to do is to tell you about a sort of an intellectual structure that I've spent the better part of the past 20 years building. I was a young physicist mainly working on particle physics, but I also did a certain amount of work on cosmology. And from that, I got interested in the question of how structures emerge in our universe from galaxies on down. Looking at that, I realized that it was actually an instance of a much more general question, which is sort of how does anything complicated get produced in nature? Whether it's snowflakes, turbulent fluid flows, forms of plants and animals, lots of others. So my first assumption was that with all the kind of sophisticated math and so on that I knew from particle physics, that I'd easily be able to figure out what was going on with these sort of ordinary everyday systems. But when I actually tried to do it, that didn't seem to work. Gradually, I started thinking that perhaps there might be sort of a fundamental problem with the whole approach that I was taking. If one looks at history, the idea of using math and mathematical equations to understand nature has been sort of a defining feature of the exact sciences for perhaps 300 years, and certainly worked out extremely well for Newton and friends in figuring out orbits of comets and for lots and lots of things since then. But somehow when the behavior that one's looking at is more complicated, it just doesn't seem to work so well. And gradually what I began to think was that that was actually why there had never really been a good theory for complicated processes in nature, in physics, and particularly in biology and so on. And I got to wondering about whether there might somehow be a way to go sort of beyond the usual paradigm of using mathematical equations in thinking about nature. Well, that was around 1981. And it so happened that at that time, I had just spent time developing a big software system called SMP that was in some ways a forerunner of Mathematica. Well, at the core of SMP was a computer language. And what I'd done to design that language was somehow to try to think about all the computations that people might want to do, and then to try to identify primitives that could be strung together to build up those computations. Well, that had worked out fairly well, and in fact, in a much evolved form, I think it's now worked out spectacularly well in Mathematica. But anyway, back in 1981, I had the idea that perhaps just as I'd been able to find primitives for computations people want to do, so also I might be able to find primitives for what nature does. And the crucial thing that I realized is that those primitives don't have to be based only on traditional mathematical constructs. I mean, if one's going to be able to do theoretical science, one has to assume that nature follows some kind of definite rules. But why should those rules involve only the kinds of constructs that have been invented in human mathematics? Numbers, exponentials, calculus, and so on. Can't the rules somehow be more general? Well, in the past, there wouldn't really have been any systematic way to think about such things. But now we have computers whose programs, in effect, implement arbitrarily general rules. And I had the idea that perhaps the kinds of rules that can be embodied in programs might actually be what nature is using. So what sorts of programs might be relevant? Well, from knowing about mathematical things, I assumed they'd have to be at least somewhat complicated. But still, I figured I should at least start by looking at really simple programs. You know, in practical computing, we're used to fairly long and complicated programs that are specifically set up for particular tasks. But what I wanted to know about were really simple, short programs, say just chosen at random. So what do programs like that do? It's sort of the simplest possible computer experiment. Run the simplest programs, see how they behave. Well, back in 1981, I came up with particular kinds of programs to try that are known as cellular automata and actually have quite a history. Well, here's how a simple one-dimensional cellular automaton works. One starts with a row of cells, each either black or white. Then the cellular automaton evolves down the page with the color of each cell on each step being determined by a definite rule from the color of the cell and its neighbors on the step before. Well, in this particular case, the rule is really simple. It just says that a cell will be black whenever it or its neighbors were black on the row before. And what happens is that we just get a simple uniform black pattern. Well, we can use that icon at the bottom there to represent the rule, the program we were using. So what happens if we change the rule a bit? Okay, well now instead of getting just a uniform black pattern, we get a checkerboard. So far, none of this is terribly surprising. We're using very simple rules, and we're getting simple patterns out. Well, let's try another rule. It's the same setup as before, but what's going on here? We don't seem to be getting any kind of simple repeating pattern. Let's run it a bit longer. It gets pretty intricate, but we can see it's still very regular. It's a self-similar or fractal pattern just formed from nested pieces. And one might think that if one has a single simple rule and just starts from a single black cell, then one would always have to get a pattern that's somehow very regular, like this. Well, at least back in 1982, that's what I assumed was true. But one day I decided to try a very systematic experiment and just to run every single one of the 256 possible simplest cellular automaton rules. Well, when I got to rule number 30, this is what I saw. So what's going on here? Let's run it some more. There's a bit of regularity over on the left, but otherwise, this looks really complicated and actually kind of random. Well, when I first saw this, I thought it might just be a problem with our visual system, that there really were regularities, but we just couldn't see them. So I ran all sorts of elaborate mathematical and statistical tests, and what I found was that no, so far as I could tell, something like the center column of cells here really was perfectly random. Well, this is rather amazing. We have a very simple rule, and we're starting off from a single black cell, but what we're getting out is an incredibly complicated pattern that seems in many ways random. It just doesn't seem right. We've put so little in, yet we're getting so much out. It's not what our ordinary intuition says should happen. I mean, in our everyday experience, and say in doing engineering, what we're used to is that to make something complicated, we somehow have to start off with complicated plans or use complicated rules. But what we're seeing here is that actually even extremely simple rules can produce incredibly complicated behavior. Well, it took me years to come to terms with this phenomenon, and in fact it's gradually overturned almost everything I thought I knew about the foundations of science. And it's what's led me to spend the past 15 years building a new intellectual structure, really a new kind of science. So having seen Rule 30, what more can happen? Here's another one of the 256 simplest cellular automata. This is rule 110. This one grows only on the left. But what's it doing? Well, let's run it a little longer. It's not making any kind of uniform randomness. Instead, we can see little complicated structures running around. But so what's going to happen? Well, the only way to find out seems to be just to keep running the system. Are we going to get more of those little structures, or are they all going to die out? What's going to happen? Well, after 2,780 steps, we finally get the answer. At least in this case, we basically end up with just one structure. But it's amazing, everything we get, just starting from one little black cell and then following a really simple rule. Well, in the mid-1980s, I'd studied a bunch of cellular automata, and I'd seen these basic phenomena. But I wasn't sure whether they were somehow specific to cellular automata or more general. And I had the practical problem that there wasn't any easy way to set up all the very different types of computer experiments that I'd have to do to find that out. And in fact, that was one of the main reasons I started building Mathematica. I wanted, once and for all, to make a system that I could use to do all the computations and all the computer experiments I'd ever want. Well, for 5 years, the task of building Mathematica in our company pretty much consumed me. But finally, in 1991, I decided I could start looking at my science questions again. Actually, it was really incredible. I mean, things that had taken me days to do before now took minutes, and it was easy to do all the experiments I wanted. I guess it was a little sort of like how it must have felt when telescopes or microscopes were first invented. One could sort of just point them somewhere and almost immediately see a whole world of new phenomena, like all those microscopic creatures swimming around in tiny drops of pond water and so on. Well, in the computational world, one just pointed Mathematica somewhere and suddenly one could see all this amazing stuff. So the first question was, just how special are cellular automata? Well, I looked at lots of cellular automata and often saw very complicated behavior. What about programs with different setups, though? Here's a Turing machine, for example. It's got a row of cells, like a cellular automaton, but unlike a cellular automaton, only one cell gets updated at each step, but that cell moves around. Well, the first quite a few Turing machines only do these kinds of things. But if one keeps going, still with very simple rules, then suddenly one sees this. It's the same kind of complexity that we saw in cellular automata. So what about other kinds of programs? Well, I looked at many, many different kinds. Sequential substitution systems that rewrite strings like an iterated text editor. Register machines, kind of like minimal idealizations of machine language. Also, symbolic systems like generalizations of combinators or kind of minimal idealizations of Mathematica. It's the same story in two dimensions, in cellular automata, or in Turing machines, or for that matter, in three dimensions. Every time one sees the same thing, even with very simple rules, one can get extremely complicated behavior. One doesn't even need rules that specify an explicit process of evolution. Constraints work too. Like, here's the simplest set of tiling constraints that force a non-periodic pattern. And here are constraints that give a kind of crystal that's forced to have a rule 30 pattern. Well, wherever one looks, it's always the same basic thing. Incredibly simple rules can give incredibly complicated behavior. It seems to be a very robust and very general phenomenon. But how come something that fundamental hasn't been well known for ages? Well, partly it's because one can only easily see it by doing lots of computer experiments, and it's only with computers, and particularly with Mathematica, that those have become easy to do. But more important is that without ordinary intuition, there just didn't seem to be any reason to try the experiments. It kind of seemed so obvious that they wouldn't show anything interesting. Well, now that one's made the clear discovery that simple programs, simple rules, can produce complicated behavior, one can go back and find all sorts of hints about that from really long ago. I mean, nearly 2,500 years ago, the Greeks looked, for example, at prime numbers. And there's a fairly simple rule, a fairly simple program for generating all the primes. But the sequence of primes, once generated, looks remarkably irregular and complicated. There's also a fairly simple rule for generating the digits of pi, but once generated, that sequence looks to us completely random. And actually, there are lots of cases of this kind of thing with numbers. Here's what happens if you just write out successive powers of 3 in base 2, kind of a minimal version of a linear congruential random number generator, and already amazingly complicated. Well, you can also make very complicated sequences from simple integer recurrences. And here, for example, is the very simplest primitive recursive function that has complex behavior. Well, what about other systems based on numbers? What about, for example, those favorite things from traditional mathematical science, partial differential equations? Does their continuous character make them work differently? Well, the ones people usually study show only rather simple behavior. But doing an automated search in the space of possible symbolic partial differential equations, I ended up finding these creatures. They're just simple nonlinear PDEs, but even with very simple initial conditions, they end up doing all sorts of complicated things. Well, actually, it's a little hard to tell exactly what they do. I mean, we use these PDEs to test our ever-improving state-of-the-art PDE-solving capabilities in Mathematica. But with continuous systems, there's always a problem, because you end up having to discretize them, and without already more or less knowing the answer, it's hard to tell whether what you're seeing is something real. And that's probably why, among mathematicians, numerical experiments can sometimes have something of a bad name. But in a discrete system, like Rule 30, there are no issues like that. The bits are the bits, and one can tell that one's seeing a real phenomenon. And actually, Rule 30 is so simple to set up, there's really no reason the Babylonians couldn't have done it. And I sometimes wonder whether, a bit like these, some ancient mosaic of Rule 30 might one day be unearthed. But I rather think that if Rule 30 had actually been known in antiquity, a lot of ideas about science and nature would have developed somewhat differently. Because as it is, it's always seemed like a big mystery how nature could manage, apparently so effortlessly, to produce so much that seems to us so complex. It's like nature has some special secret that allows it to make things that are more complex than we as humans normally build. And often it seemed that that must be evidence that there's something somehow beyond human intelligence involved. But once one's seen Rule 30, it suggests a very different explanation. It suggests that all it takes is for things in nature to follow the rules of typical simple programs, and then it's almost inevitable that, like in the case of Rule 30, their behavior can be highly complex. I mean, the way we as humans are used to doing engineering and to building things, we tend to operate under the constraint that we have to foresee what the things we're building are going to do. And that means that we've ended up being forced to use only a very special set of programs that happen always to have simple foreseeable behavior. But the point is that nature is presumably under no such constraint. So that means that there's nothing wrong with it using something like Rule 30, and that way inevitably producing all sorts of complexity. Well, once one starts thinking in terms of simple programs, it's kind of amazing how easily one can start to understand the essential features of what's going on in all sorts of systems in nature. So as a simple example, let's talk about snowflakes. Well, crystals grow by starting from a seed, then successively adding pieces of solid. And one can try to capture that with a two-dimensional cellular automaton. I mean, imagine a grid where every cell either has solid in it or not. Then start from a seed and have a rule that says solid will be added at any cell that's adjacent to one that's already solid. Here's what one gets. It's an ordinary-looking faceted crystal here on a square grid. One could do the same thing on a hexagonal grid. But for snowflakes, there's an important effect missing here. I mean, when a piece of ice solidifies from water vapor, there's some latent heat released, and that inhibits more ice from solidifying nearby. Well, what's the simplest way to capture that effect? One can just change the cellular automaton to say that ice gets added only if the number of neighboring cells that are already ice is exactly one. It looks incredibly similar to the patterns that we get from cellular automata like Rule 30. In an actual shell, the pattern is laid down by a line of pigment-producing cells on the growing edge of the shell, and it seems that what happens can be captured rather well by a cellular automaton rule. So why one rule and not another? Well, if one looks at different species, one sees all sorts of different patterns. But the neat thing is that there are definite classes of patterns that one sees that correspond remarkably well with the classes of behavior that one sees in cellular automata. It's sort of as if the mollusks of the world are sampling the space of possible simple programs, and we get to see the results displayed on their shells. Sort of with all the emphasis on natural selection, one's kind of gotten used to the idea that there just can't be much of a fundamental theory in biology, and that the things one sees in current organisms must just reflect detailed accidents in the history of biological evolution. But what this mollusk shell example suggests is that things might be different, and that instead it might be reasonable to think of different types of organisms as somehow uniformly sampling a whole space of possible programs. So let me give one more example. Shapes of leaves. One might think that these are too diverse to explain in a uniform way, but actually it turns out that there's a simple type of program that seems to capture almost all of them. It just involves successive repeated branchings. And what's remarkable is that the limiting shapes one gets look just like actual leaves, sometimes smooth, sometimes jagged, and so on. Well, here's a simple case where one can actually lay out sort of all of the possible shapes that one gets. And one thing one can see is that varying a parameter can change not only quantitatively, but also qualitatively what kind of leaf one gets, and therefore also potentially change how it can function biologically. Well, to be a little more sophisticated, one can kind of summarize features of possible leaves in a parameter space set that turns out to be a rather interesting, simpler, linear analog of the Mandelbrot set. And from the properties of the set, one can deduce all sorts of features of leaves and their likely evolution. Well, okay, there's a lot to say about how one can use ideas about simple programs to capture what's going on in biology, both at the macroscopic levels of the kind I've been talking about and at molecular levels. But let me now turn for a few minutes back to physics, and in particular, fundamental physics. Well, traditional mathematical approaches have obviously had lots of success there, but still they haven't been able to give us a truly fundamental theory of physics. And I suspect that the reason for that is that really one needs more primitives, not just the ones from traditional mathematics, but also the more general ones that one can have in programs. And now that we've seen that very simple programs can produce immensely rich and complex behavior, one can't help wondering whether perhaps all the amazing things that we see in our universe couldn't just be the result of some particular simple program. I mean, that'd be pretty exciting, to have a little program that's a precise, ultimate model of our universe, so that if one just runs the program long enough, it'll reproduce every single thing that happens in our universe. But okay, so what might such a program be like? Well, one thing that's kind of inevitable is that very few familiar features of our universe will immediately be visible in the program. So if the program is small, then it's inevitable that very little that's sort of familiar in the universe as we know it should be visible in the program, because there just isn't room for that. There's no way to fit in separate identifiable pieces that represent electrons or gravity or even space or time. And in fact, I think that if the program's going to be really small, it sort of has to have the very least possible structure already built in. And for example, I think a cellular automaton already has far too much structure built in. For example, it's got a whole rigid array of cells laid out in space. And it also separates the notion of space from the notion of states of cells. And I don't think one even needs that. I mean, in ordinary physics, space is a kind of background on top of which matter and everything else exists. But I think that in an ultimate model, one needs only space, and one doesn't need any other basic concepts. Well, okay, so given that, sort of, what might space be? Well, we normally think of space as just being something that is, not something that has any kind of underlying structure. But I think it's a little like what happens with fluids. Our everyday experience is that something like water is a continuous fluid. But we actually know that underneath it's made up of lots of little discrete molecules. And I think something similar is happening with space, and that at a small enough scale, space is just a huge collection of discrete points. And actually, I think it's really a giant network with a changing pattern of connections between points, where all that's specified is how each point, each node, is connected to others. So in the end, there'll probably be lots of ways to formulate it, but a simple one is just to say that each point is connected to exactly three other points, making a kind of trivalent network. Well, okay, so how can anything like space as we know it come from that? Well, actually, it's quite easy, and in fact, one can have networks that correspond to space in any number of dimensions. So here are some examples. This is one dimension, two dimensions, three dimensions. And what's important here is that these are all just trivalent networks. The only thing that's different is the pattern of connections between the nodes. Well, I've drawn these to make the correspondence with ordinary space clear, but it's important to realize that there's absolutely no intrinsic information in the actual network about how it should be drawn. It's just a bunch of nodes with a certain pattern of connections. Well, okay, so given a pattern of connections, how do we tell whether it corresponds to one-dimensional, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, or whatever, space? It's actually quite easy. Think about starting at a particular node, then go to all nodes that take one connection to reach, then two, then three, and so on. Well, what one's doing here is to form some kind of circle or sphere or something, and then the thing to do is just to ask how many nodes there are inside that after one's gone, say, r connections. In two dimensions, it'd be roughly the area of a circle, pi r squared. In three dimensions, the volume of a sphere, four-thirds pi r cubed, and so on. And in general, in d dimensions, it'd be something that grows like r to the d. So given a network, that's how one can tell how many dimensions one's in. Well, okay, that's a little on space. So what about time? In the usual mathematical formulation of physics, space and time are always very much the same kind of thing, just different variables corresponding to different dimensions. But when one looks at programs, they seem much more different. I mean, in a cellular automaton, for example, one moves in space by going from one cell to another, but one moves in time by actually applying the cellular automaton rule. Okay, so can space and time really be that different? Well, it's all rather tricky, but I think at the lowest level they are. It's definitely not like in a cellular automaton, though, because in a cellular automaton there's some kind of global clock with every cell getting updated in parallel at every tick. Well, it's hard to imagine how such a global clock could exist in our universe. Okay, so what might actually be going on? Well, here's something that at first seems crazy. How about if the universe works like a Turing machine, or what I call a mobile automaton, where at each step there's only one cell that's getting updated? There's no problem with synchronization here, because there's only one place where anything happens at a time. But how can this possibly be right? I mean, after all, we normally have the impression that everything in the universe is going through time together. I certainly don't have the impression that what's happening is that sort of first I'm getting updated, then you're getting updated, and so on. But the point is, how would I know? Because until I'm updated, I can't tell whether you've been updated or not. Well, if one follows this all the way through, one realizes that all we can ever actually know about in the end is a kind of causal network of what event influences what other event. And here's an example of how one can go from an underlying sequence of updates, in this case in a mobile automaton, to a causal network. And the important thing here is that even though the updates affect only one cell at a time, the final causal network corresponds to something kind of uniform in space-time. Okay, so how might time work in the context of the space networks I talked about before? The obvious thing is to imagine that there's an updating rule that says that whenever there's a piece of network that has a particular form, it should get replaced by a piece of network with another form. So here are some examples of rules like that. But there's an immediate problem. If there are several places in the network where a particular rule could apply, where should one update first? Well, in general, different updating orders will lead to different causal networks, and one will sort of get a whole tree of possible histories for the universe. And then to say what actually happens in our universe, one will somehow have to have more information to say what branch one's on. Well, I don't consider that very plausible, but it turns out that there's another rather subtle possibility. It turns out that with appropriate kinds of underlying rules, it actually doesn't matter what order they get applied in. There's what I call causal invariance. That means that the causal networks one gets out are exactly the same. So, for those of you who know about such things, this is related to the so-called confluence or Church-Rosser properties in rewrite systems. It's also related to the way that Mathematica, for example, manages to find canonical forms for expressions. But anyway, there are conditions about avoiding overlaps, which turn out, for example, to allow rules based on graphs like these. And whenever one uses just these graphs, for example, one has causal invariance, and that means that in a sense there's always just a single thread of time in the universe. Well, okay, in addition to making there be a single thread of time, this setup has another important consequence. It turns out to immediately imply that special relativity must hold. So it's a slightly complicated story. For those of you who know about such things, let me just say that different updating orders correspond to different space-like hypersurfaces, and that's why, subject to various tricky issues of limits and averages and so on, causal invariance implies relativistic invariance. Here's an example of a network that corresponds to flat two-dimensional space. But what happens if we change the connections so that we mix some heptagons or some pentagons into those hexagons? The answer is that we get a space that bulges out or bulges in. Remember that in two dimensions, the number of nodes we get by going out a distance r is supposed to grow like r squared. Well, in ordinary flat space, it's exactly r squared. But in curved space, there's a correction term, and it turns out that that's proportional to the so-called Ricci scalar curvature. Well, that's already kind of interesting, because the Ricci scalar curvature is exactly a thing that appears in the Einstein equations that specify the structure of space-time in general relativity. The whole story is quite complicated. We actually need to look at curvature not just in space, but in space-time defined by causal networks. But it then turns out that the growth rates of volumes of space-time cones are related to the so-called Ricci tensor. And then with certain microscopic randomness and other conditions, it looks like one can derive conditions on the Ricci tensor. And it turns out that they're exactly the Einstein equations. So there are many issues and caveats, but it's rather exciting. It seems like from almost nothing, one's been able to derive a major feature of our universe, namely general relativity and gravity. Okay, so another major thing in our universe is particles, like electrons and photons and so on. Well, remember that all we have in the universe is space. So how can we get particles? Well, here's how it can work in something like a cellular automaton. Here's a particular cellular automaton, happens to be our friend Rule 110. We start off from random initial colors of cells at the top, but what we see is that the system quickly organizes itself into a few persistent localized structures, and these localized structures act just like particles. So here are a couple of collisions between them, for example. Two particles come in, after a certain amount of interaction, a whole bunch of particles come out. It almost looks like an explicit version of a Feynman diagram in particle physics. Well, okay, so how does something like this work in a network? Well, what happens is that the particles end up being based on definite little tangles, like, for example, non-planar pieces in otherwise planar graphs. Well, talking about particles brings up quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is really a big bundle of mathematical results and constructs, and it's certainly not easy to see how to derive it all from the underlying theory that I've been talking about. And actually, just to make things even more complicated, my guess is that it'll in the end be easier to derive quantum field theory than quantum mechanics, just like it's easier to go from molecular dynamics to fluid dynamics than to rigid body dynamics. But still, we can see a few things quite easily. I mean, the way quantum mechanics is usually set up, it has a kind of fundamental randomness built in. But my theory is completely deterministic. But the point is that it makes its own randomness. And actually, that randomness is crucial not only in giving quantum mechanics, but even in building up things like space and time. Well, one might think that with underlying determinism, there couldn't be the kinds of correlations that one needs to violate Bell's inequalities to get what's observed in quantum mechanics. But it turns out that that conclusion relies on some basic assumptions about space-time. And with my network setup, it's actually quite easy to at least imagine getting the kinds of correlations one wants. Roughly, it can happen by there being sort of a few long-distance network connections between particles that just aren't part of the usual 3+1 dimensional space-time structure. And in fact, it's sort of quite amazing how many features of known physics one seems to be able to get rather easily from the kind of simple programs I've been talking about. And I must say that this all makes me increasingly hopeful that it'll really be possible to find a single simple program that really is the ultimate program for the universe. I mean, there are lots of technical difficulties, a lot of tools that have to be built. In fact, you can watch for many of those in future versions of Mathematica. But I think, in the end, it's going to work, and it's going to be pretty exciting. I think computational irreducibility is a pretty important phenomenon that's relevant even beyond what are normally viewed as purely scientific issues, like, for example, to the problem of free will. I mean, it's always seemed mysterious how we manage to act in ways that seem free of obvious predictive laws if it's the case that our brains actually follow definite underlying laws. But I think a crucial ingredient of the answer is computational irreducibility, that even with definite underlying laws, there can still be no effective way to predict what a system will do, except in effect just by running the system and seeing what happens. Computational irreducibility can also be viewed as what leads to the phenomenon of undecidability, originally discovered in the 1930s. Look at this cellular automaton, for example, and ask the question, starting from a given initial condition, will the pattern that's produced eventually die out, or will it just keep going forever? So, in this case up here, just running the cellular automaton tells one that after 36 steps, it dies out. In this case, it takes 1,017 steps to find that out. In these cases here, even after 10 million steps, it's still not clear what's going to happen. And the point is that if there's computational irreducibility, there's no way to shortcut this evolution. So there's no finite computation at all that can always figure out what will happen after an infinite time. And that means that one has to say that it's in general formally undecidable what will happen. Well, undecidability has been known about in mathematics and in computer science for quite a long time. But with the principle of computational equivalence, one realizes now that it's also relevant to natural science. If one asks questions about infinite time or infinite size limits, the answers can be undecidable, like whether a body will ever escape in a gravitational three-body problem, or whether some idealized biological cell line will grow forever or will eventually die out, or whether there's a way to arrange some complicated molecule into a crystal below a certain temperature. Actually, I expect that when there are things that seem so random that they just have to get tabulated in things like chemical tables, it's a sign that there's computational irreducibility at work. Well, there's another big place where I think computational irreducibility is very important, and that's in the foundations of mathematics. It may sound kind of obvious, but it's really a deep observation about mathematics that it's often hard to do. Yet it's based on pretty simple axioms. In fact, right here are the ones for essentially all of current mathematics. But even though these axioms are simple, proofs of things like the four-color theorem or Fermat's last theorem are really long. And it turns out that one can think of that as just another case of the phenomenon of computational irreducibility. Let me show you a little bit about how that works. Here's an example of a simple proof in mathematics. These are some axioms that in this case specify equivalences in logic, and this is a proof. It starts from one expression at the top, then keeps on using the axioms and eventually proves the theorem that the expression at the top is equivalent to the one at the bottom. Well, okay, so as a kind of minimal idealization of mathematics, one can imagine that the axioms just define transformations between strings. So with the axioms at the bottom here, here are proofs of a few theorems. But so how long do these proofs need to be? Well, here's a picture for three axiom systems showing the network of all possible transformations. And the way this works, every possible path through each network corresponds to the proof of some theorem. Well, the point is that the shortest path from one particular string to another may be really long. And that means that the theorem that the strings are equivalent has only a really long proof. Well, when people were thinking about formalizing mathematics a century ago, they kind of assumed that in any given axiom system, it would always eventually be possible to give a proof of whether a particular statement was true or false. So it was a big shock in 1931 when Gödel's theorem showed that that wasn't true for piano arithmetic, the standard formal axiom system for ordinary integer arithmetic. But what Gödel actually did, though, was to look at the kind of funky self-referential statement, this statement is unprovable. Well, just by what it says, this statement fairly obviously can't be proved true or false. But as such, it doesn't seem like a statement in arithmetic. And Gödel's real achievement was essentially to show that arithmetic is universal, so that in particular it can encode his funky statement. Well, for the foundations of math, Gödel's theorem was a pretty big deal. But somehow in all these years, it's never seemed too relevant to most of the things that working mathematicians deal with. And if you needed something like Gödel's funky statement to get undecidability, that wouldn't be surprising. But here's the thing. The principle of computational equivalence should be general enough to apply to systems in mathematics. So, and it then says that computational irreducibility and undecidability should actually not be rare at all. So where are all these undecidable statements in mathematics? Well, it's been known for a while that there are integer equations, so-called Diophantine equations, about which there are undecidable statements. Here's an actual example, a Diophantine equation explicitly set up to emulate rule 110. Well, this is obviously pretty complicated and not something that would kind of show up every day. But what about simpler Diophantine equations? So here are a bunch. Linear Diophantine equations were cracked in antiquity, quadratic ones around 1800. And so far, another kind seems to be cracked roughly every 50 or 100 years. But I'm guessing that that's not going to go on, and that actually many of the currently unsolved problems in number theory will turn out to be undecidable. Okay, but why has so much math successfully been done without running into undecidability? I think it's kind of like theoretical physics. It's tended to stick to places where there's computational reducibility and where its methods can make progress. But at least in recent times, mathematics has prided itself on somehow being very general. So then, why haven't Rule 30 and Rule 110 and all the phenomena I found in simple programs showed up? Well, I think part of the reason is that mathematics isn't really quite as general as advertised. To see what it could be, one can imagine just enumerating possible axiom systems. And for example, this shows what theorems are true for a sequence of different axiom systems. It's like an ultimately desiccated form of mathematics. The axioms go down the left here, the theorems go across the top, and every time there's a theorem that's true for a particular axiom system, there's a black dot. So is there something special about the actual axiom systems that get used in mathematics? Perhaps something that makes undecidability less rampant? Well, if one looks at axiom systems from textbooks, they're usually pretty complicated. Here's logic, for example. Well, it's been known for 100 years that one doesn't have to have all those operators in there. The single NAND operator or Sheffer stroke is enough. But the obvious axiom system with that is still pretty complicated. Well, from all the intuition that I built up about simple programs, I suspected that there should actually be a really simple axiom system for logic, probably with just one axiom. And so I searched for it, and eventually I found it. And I know that this is the very simplest possible axiom system for logic. Here's the proof, by the way, needless to say, generated by computer. Well, knowing this, I can say that if one just enumerates axiom systems, logic will be about the 50,000th one that one reaches. What about all the other ones, though? Well, most of them are perfectly reasonable axiom systems, too. They just don't happen to be known fields of mathematics. And actually, I think mathematics, as it's developed, has been, in a sense, tremendously constrained. At some level, it's still pretty much just the various direct generalizations of the arithmetic and geometry that got studied in ancient Babylon. Well, if one starts looking at simple programs and just doing experiments, one immediately sees a much wider world, a sort of huge generalization of what mathematics has been so far. Well, okay, let me turn now to a somewhat different topic. I want to talk about sort of what the principle of computational equivalence says about sort of a big question, our place in the universe. Well, it's always been natural for us to think that we as humans are very special, but the history of science keeps on showing us ways in which we're not. For example, 400 years ago, we found out that our Earth isn't at a special place in the universe. And a century and a half ago, we found out that there wasn't anything special about the origin of our species. Well, every time we lose something in specialness, science gets more general, because it can drop another footnote that says, quotes, except in the case of humans. But right now, we still often think we're special in our level of complexity or our computational ability. But one of the big statements that the principle of computational equivalence makes is that that isn't right. It says that there are lots of simple abstract systems and systems in nature that are exactly equivalent in terms of their computational sophistication. Well, one sometimes has that impression anyway. For example, when one says something like, the weather has a mind of its own. But what the principle of computational equivalence now says is that, yes, fluid turbulence in the atmosphere will correspond to as sophisticated a computation as anything we do. So we're not special that way. Well, one of the things this has a consequence for is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. There's sort of been an idea that if we saw a signal that was produced by a sophisticated computation, then there'd be no choice but to conclude that it came from a sophisticated extraterrestrial civilization. The principle of computational equivalence says, no, it's actually easy to do sophisticated computations, and lots of things in nature do them. It doesn't take our whole biological development and civilization to manage it. And that's, by the way, sort of why it's so hard to distinguish random radio noise from some kind of intelligent, compressed, encrypted signal. Well, okay, so where does this leave us? It's sort of interesting to think about how we interact with the ultimate limits of technology. Well, I don't have any doubt that there'll be a time, potentially quite soon, when it'll be possible to capture all the important features of human thinking in pieces of solid-state electronics. And no doubt things will get more and more efficient until everything is on an atomic scale, so that our processes of human thinking are just implemented by sort of individual electrons whizzing around in lumps of something. Well, of course, there are electrons whizzing around in all sorts of complicated patterns in ordinary pieces of rock, too. And what the principle of computational equivalence tells us is that we can't expect the patterns made by the ones that represent human thinking to be ultimately any more sophisticated than those that occur naturally in something like a rock. There sort of isn't any abstract essence of human intelligence that one can identify. But what, of course, is still special about us is all our details and all our history. And in a sense, it's the principle of computational equivalence that shows us that that history can really add up to something. Because if everything was computationally reducible, then in a sense, nothing could be achieved by history. We'd always be able to get to the same end point without all that effort. It's interesting what the principle of computational equivalence ends up saying. It kind of encapsulates both the great strength and the great weakness of science. Because on one hand, it says that all the wonders of our universe can be captured by simple rules, yet it also says that there's ultimately no way to know the consequences of those rules, except in effect just to watch and see how they unfold. Well, it's remarkable to me what's grown from those little computer experiments that I did in the early 1980s. It's been very exciting. You know, when I actually started writing my book in 1991, I thought it would not take very long. But I just kept on discovering more and more things. I kept on looking at different areas, just kept on finding all this wonderful stuff. One thing, though, was really scary. It seemed like I just kept on finding things that disagreed with existing conventional wisdom that at least I'd always believed. And actually sort of having the confidence to see beyond that was one of the biggest personal challenges in what I did. I mean, people who've looked at the notes part of my book will know that I put a lot of effort into tracking down history. And one of the main reasons for that was that that was how I finally got convinced about things I figured out. by knowing how enough about history to see why a field took the path it did rather than what I now think it could have done. Well, back in the 1980s, I used to write academic papers about what I was doing. I think it's fair to say that they were well received. They certainly generated some big literature trees and so on. But by the 1990s, particularly with Mathematica, I was beginning to discover new things very quickly. And soon I had material for many tens, perhaps hundreds of papers. But most of all, I was beginning to build up a pretty big intellectual structure. And it was very clear that a bunch of papers scattered across all sorts of fields wouldn't be able to communicate that. So I decided I had to just keep working until I'd finished and until I could present everything in a single coherent way. Well, it took a lot of personal focus to do that, but even though I continued to be the CEO of a very active company, I ended up working on my science every day and every night for more than 10 years. I talked to experts when I needed to, particularly about history, but mostly I just kept to myself. And I kept on polishing everything until I could really explain it clearly. And gradually I filled in all the parts of the book that I wanted to write. And finally, early last year, the writing was finished. Well, the book I'd made didn't fit very well any of the usual existing models in the publishing industry, so I ended up deciding that it was easier just to publish it through our own company. Well, one of the big questions is always then, how many copies should one print? Well, we talked to some people, and needless to say, the responses were all over the map. Some were saying, you know, this is terrific stuff, print lots. Others were saying, you're crazy, nobody's going to be interested. Well, in the end, I decided to print 50,000 copies, and on May 14th, they were done and the book was officially published. What happened was actually rather exciting. By the end of the day, on May 14th, all the 50,000 copies we had printed were spoken for. Well, then things really started happening. A huge response in many communities and in the media, some of it very sensible, some of it pretty wild and woolly. And really all the classic signs of the early stages of a kind of paradigm shift. Well, as a student of the history of science, I've certainly read a lot about paradigm shifts. But it's pretty scary to see one up close. I mean, to see the actual dynamics and emotions of the whole thing that you never see when you just learn about the science and the ideas years later. Of course, it helps me a lot that I've seen at least some of this before, because when Mathematica came out in 1988, I think it's fair to say that it too led to something of a paradigm shift. And as usual, there was a certain amount of turbulence at the beginning. But gradually, almost invisibly, it worked itself out. And now, almost 15 years later, it's sort of like, hasn't it always been this way? Of course, there's still much more to come with Mathematica, particularly when some of the ideas in Mathematica about symbolic programming and so on really get absorbed. But the NKS paradigm shift is much, much bigger, and it'll certainly take many years, many decades to work its way through. I think it's off to a really good start, though. I mean, of course, there's the usual Kuhnian stuff going on, people saying, this must be just like thing X that I've seen before, or no, nothing like this can possibly be right, or this just isn't science the way I think of science. Well, it took me 20 years to come to terms with what I discovered, and so far the book has been out for less than a year, but I'm really impressed at how fast lots of people are understanding things and really starting to work on things. I mean, I wrote the book very carefully. It's nice to know that there are lots of people who've actually read it cover to cover multiple times. By the way, I might mention that if you're just dipping into the book, you should read both the beginning and the end of the main text. And don't forget the notes. The whole second half of the book is historical and technical notes about all kinds of things. And if there's some particular area that you know well, you might just start off by looking at the notes about it. That seems to be a good way for many specialized folk to get into the book. One thing that's great about the technical notes was that I was able to use Mathematica everywhere as the notation, and that ended up working out really well. It let me say a lot in each line really clearly, and of course it also has the huge advantage that not only can you read it, you can also actually run it. And in fact, you can download all the programs from the book with test examples and so on from the Wolfram Science website. By the way, in version 4.2 of Mathematica, which came out soon after the book, we added a very efficient built-in cellular automaton function, kind of to commemorate the book coming out. Well, within the book, a lot of the presentation is very graphical, and of course all the graphics were made by Mathematica programs. And it turns out that with some nifty new technology of ours, we've been able to take those programs and make a standalone piece of software from them. It's called NKS Explorer, and it lets almost anyone reproduce the main pictures in the book and then go on and do their own experiments. Actually, it's really amazing how easily one can discover stuff with NKSX. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of science that can be done with it. Well, you know, my book is really just the beginning. I mean, it's been exciting over the past 6 months or so to see just how many people have gotten energized to work on the ideas in it. Actually, it's been quite overwhelming. And it's made me really want to figure out just what the best infrastructure is to make all this stuff really prosper. We're already organizing some things that have started appearing on the Wolfram from Science website. There's quite a bit of reference material related to the book. There'll gradually be more. There'll also soon be a large collection of open problems, an average of about one for every page of the book. And there'll be a huge repository of information about specific simple programs, about sort of what's out there in the computational world. Well, we've been working on a number of educational initiatives, too. This summer we'll be having the first NKS summer school, mostly for graduate students, at Brown University. And right before that, at the end of June, we'll be having a big three-day NKS event, actually, right here in Boston. It's called NKS 2003, and it'll be a combination of an intensive sort of mini-course about NKS together with a conference discussing lots of things related to NKS. I think it'll be pretty interesting. I mean, there'll certainly be a fascinating cross-section of people there, and at least for you all, it should be easy to get to. You know, one might have thought that once one had finished figuring out all the things in NKS and then writing a book about them, that would sort of be enough. And certainly in all the extra time that I've had from not being in the middle of writing NKS, it's been great working on Mathematica version 5 and version 6 and really digging into all the terrific things that I've realized one can do with what we've built in Mathematica over the past decade. I'm sort of also gradually recovering from the actual process of writing NKS, not being a recluse anymore, going out and giving talks and getting ready to take the next steps to make the ideas in the book grow and prosper in the best possible way in the world, and sort of building more tools to do what I like doing best of all, which is to come up with new ideas and figure out new things. What's going to happen with all the stuff I've talked about here today? Well, it's going to be a long story, played out over at least many decades, but I think three big things will emerge. First, a new area of basic science, like a physics or a chemistry or a mathematics, but concerned with understanding sort of what's out there in the computational world. Second, a whole bunch of applications to science, to technology, and to other things. Lots of new raw material for making models of all sorts of things, including perhaps our whole universe. But also lots of new directions for technology, because now we have all these new mechanisms, not just gears and wheels and things, but things like Rule 30, too, that give us access to many more of the things that nature can do, and that also give us new ways, for example, to approach making algorithms or doing nanotechnology. But there's also a kind of conceptual direction, understanding more about the fundamental character of science and mathematics and about our place in the universe, and in a sense giving a new framework for thinking about things in general and a new foundation for a basic thread in education, sort of an alternative to mathematics. There are just so many possibilities, so many things to be discovered, so much sort of low-hanging fruit to be picked. Well, I wish I'd been able to tell you more here today. I've really only been able to scratch the surface, but I hope I've been able to communicate at least a little of what's in that big book of mine and what at least I've been so excited about all of these years. Thank you very much.
Stephen Wolfram, creator of Mathematica and author of A New Kind of Science, speaking this past spring at the George Sherman Union. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Perotti with help from Boris Strapotsky, Matt Odette, and Glenn Alexander. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.